Hi, I'm Howard Melnichuk. I'm an artist who's looking at technology as like a site where power is actively happening and maybe looking at ways that we can use technology to strengthen community and to sort of give back control and give back power and autonomy to individuals and to communities. That's a big question, how I understand technology, and probably like the central question. I don't know. Especially things like AI. We're kind of entering a world now with like machine learning and AI where it could possibly move into like sort of like thinking of it in terms of like another intelligence, but we're very much in the realm where they are only reflective. So I mean, it's interesting to think if there could be a position where new things are generated and and it is like, a generative sort of process. I mean, the sort of like big example of that is like the AlphaGo move,
Right.
where it made a move that like no human would ever f had ever thought to do.
Right. You're talking about the Chinese
Yeah,
game
so it's
of
the
Go,
yeah, so it's the
where
they were playing Go and they trained an AI to like play Go, and it made this move 17, I think it's called. It was like the 17th move, and when it did it, everyone was like, "Oh, it's broken! Like, it's not. No, why has it done that? Like, that's a ridiculous move." But actually, it was part of a game plan that it could see that the other players couldn't see. But again, this is still within the sort of realm of like games, which is something that's extremely well tailored to computers and to AI. You know, like this is something, you know. It's quite interesting to go off on a tangent here, but when there was like some task, like if you look at like computer vision, like the task of like can computers see, the first inroads into this was like in the 1970s sometime, was set as like a summer project for a computing school where they were trying to build a bot that could play chess, and they thought it'd be a fun project to just get it to recognize the chess pieces. And to this day, you know, we've had chess playing robots for 30 years now, but we're only just sort of getting intelligence around computer vision, and it turns out that's a lot bigger problem. But it was originally thought that it would just be like a some you know sort of fun summer project, like you know side project to this main event of like playing chess. But playing chess is incredibly easy for a robot because it's just thinking, you know, you can just think several moves ahead, which is actually quite hard for like our mushy human brains to
Right.
do. But then AlphaGo, yeah, this move that was brand new. Yeah, I mean, it's now sort of that was in its way sort of a generative idea. It was given all the sort of all the you know moves and all the training it had, and it was like, why not this? But it was really just because it didn't have the sort of cultural upbringing of like being a Go player and knowing what is a sensible move and what's a sort of wild move. And it was you know it'll go down in history as this like changing the game kind of thing. And it was what led it to win that game. So,
Maybe you could think of the phrase beginner's luck
yeah, well,
in
yeah,
kind of
right.
similar terms, right?
It's that naivety. It's that
You
kind of you know, it has no reason to think that this isn't a sensible move because it's
Right.
been you know shown. But if it's not a move that it was ever shown, why did it think of it? Is the kind of the is the interesting question about it. And people are studying this, like, why? How did it get to that point? And that kind of thing. And it is interesting because with a model like that, you can't just go in and be like, what were the decisions it made to get to that point? You kind of can only see from outputs, like kind of, and try to, you know, figure out what was going on inside.
So it's not recorded, the thought process.
Well, I mean, it's just so much more complex than that because the way that these sort of nets work and things like that is they're so, like, even if you saw all the decisions it made, it wouldn't make sense to you. Like, you wouldn't. Be up, it wouldn't necessarily tell you like why is it making that decision, and they're so enormous that you couldn't just point to one decision and be like, oh, I can see why that had this chain reaction. So yeah, they are like yeah, they kind of become these black boxes where we then just sort of tinker with them to try and see like what are their biases and why are they doing things like certain ways.
You started off as a photographer.
So I originally like well I originally actually studied
Filmmaking,
filmmaking.
right?
Visions of
And
becoming a filmmaker, and then I became a photographer sort of professionally, and then it was much later that I sort of got into computing, and it was also around the same time, or like not that long before, that I was sort of began thinking of myself as an artist, because prior to that I was like a photographer, which is a you know type of artist, but like it wasn't so much like you know, this kind of the art practice I have now is very much growing up at the same time as my interest in like programming and stuff like that.
Because I'm looking at the project of yours from 2016 that's called On the Side of Every Mountain is Another Smaller Mountain. And it says that it explores the complexities of nature and fractal complexities. This is a point of view of someone who would be interested in these digital technologies and computing. So could you tell us a bit about the conceptual side of your transition of your journey as an
Yes.
artist?
I don't know if you've read an essay by Willem Flusser, well, a book called Towards a Philosophy of Photography, where it's kind of his big work on photography, where he talks about a lot of things, but it's kind of just it's a really good book. It's not very long. And in that he talks about the camera as an apparatus, and like what is its sort of like if you were to look at the world from the camera's point of view, like what does it want to see happen in the world? And he kind of says, like, he talks about this idea of the camera taking every photo possible. And so if you're taking a new photo, are you taking a new photo that adds to its kind of like you know, reason for being, and it's sort of like teleological like goal of like photographing everything. And when I was reading this, I began to think of it as like this is kind of how the internet is. Like the internet, and you know, you look at these sort of like big internet projects like Google. When they set out, they were like, we want to index every single artifact, every single file available. That was their project, right? And you know, to do that, they had to build these like incredibly invasive scraping systems that go around indexing every single website in order that they could build a search algorithm that would find the file you wanted when you wanted it. And this was originally why the internet was set up, as a way of like sharing files between institutions, between and you know, sharing sort of military intelligence. And I began to see these links between sort of photography, and especially photography in the age of like Instagram or the internet, or as being, you know, you couldn't think of it removed from that context, because like every single image then falls into a context of all the images around it and all the like how they're all connected. And
Right, it's no longer an intimate act of art making in a sense.
I mean, it's interesting, but like, it's like, why does it, if you made an intimate image, what makes it intimate? And like, as soon as you show an image to somebody else, which is for a lot of people the primary, like, what you do when you make an image, like, there's a difference between like if you made an image just for yourself, and if you put an image out there, it changes the context massively. And like, as soon as you're looking at somebody else's image, or you're looking at an image that you don't remember taking, maybe it takes on this context of like how it fits into like the wider world.
So, which geometrical figure do you prefer, a triangle or a circle?
I don't know. Triangle probably. I find,
Triangle.
yeah, I mean, the triangle is like creative. I mean, circles have a false, like a false identity as being egalitarian, but they're not. There's a center and there's an edge, so they are very much. I mean, like, if anything, a triangle is one step above a circle. If you, because a circle is just a line going around. I mean, there's an edge and a middle, and there'll always be a hierarchy between those two things. Whereas a triangle, you know, you can rotate it, and it will, you know, I don't know. So yeah, I guess I'd say
Right.
triangle.
I'm talking about Howard's essay and general interest in what is popularly probably called the occult, but within the context of the digital era and geometry matters apparently.
I mean, it was more, so I'd been thinking, I mean, geometry and sort of numbers and this kind of thing have like a big presence in the occult. They have a kind of, there's lots of, they relate to symbolism a lot. They relate to numerology, obviously, a lot. They relate to tarot as well. The sort of the 10 digits have become the sort of transit, the journey of tarot. And sort of the numbers have different symbolisms. I was thinking that that was interesting, because this is a kind of this history of the occult is what's interesting about it is it's very much it's nobody has sat down and decided this is what the occult believes. You know, these are the set of beliefs they kind of build on over the course of history. Like, people can change them as they want. There's no central figure who, you know, like, there's no pope of the occult that says this is canon and this isn't canon. And it's quite similar in some ways to how a lot of like computer systems, especially in back in when you're looking at open source software, arise. And these sort of numbers of like a creative, like a, you know, like a triangle as a creative force versus a circle as like a virtual force, take on interesting resonances in within that, because like what can be computed and what can't be computed is the study of that is what computer science is trying to look at. But there definitely is like, you know, there definitely are virtual concepts like in mathematics that like don't exist in reality. And there are, you know, and if you have something, computer graphics or like image making in general is an attempt to often render the imaginary or the virtual into the real. And this is kind of a tension that that is also felt in computing. So the idea, like, so in graphics, for example, you have everything is made up of, well, a lot of things are made up of triangles, like as the sort of basic, you know, it's the most simple shape that will have a 2D surface to it. And so you just sort of string them together to make more complex images. But like you sort of ascent, you're approaching sort of infinite of a circle, but you will never actually reach it. The Instagram algorithm, as like as it's devised, is, you know, it's specifically designed to try and incentivize image taking, mainly to like, you know, boost Facebook's advertising revenue. Like, you know, like the more images that are taken, the more use of the application of like how of using Instagram, the more money Facebook makes. So it's that kind of, you know, they are trying to engineer this, as it were. Yeah.
Right, so we're kind of heading towards that other topic that you seem to be working on, and that is probably to say the power politics or power relations behind digital technologies. And I'm thinking of Rosetta piece that you did. That was very fascinating.
Trying to remember now, like quite what was the inciting sort of moment of inspiration to for that piece, but I mean it was mainly a working as like a critique of like Google's sort of ongoing accumulation of your personal data, right? And like as a sort of like free resource that you use, and like, you know, as a communication device, like using your Gmail to send emails, like you know you are like offering so much of yourself to basically an anonymous actor that you have no idea about. And what was very interesting with that work, maybe I should explain how it works for the
Yeah, why
perhaps.
not? Sure.
So basically the idea behind it was sort of a web application and digital and like real installation, where if you agreed to consent to the application, as like in the same way you do when you're using like a Chrome plugin, say, it would have access, you'd give it access to all your sent emails. And from your sent emails, it would try to work out four sentences, the sort of the most typical thing you email about. And then it would use those emails to gather, basically do Google searches and just get images and text. And then it would produce this into like a zine that it arranged, and it would print out in the exhibition, and you got to take this home. And the idea was like in between, at one end, Google's like enormous apparatus of like, data extraction and like understanding, you know, trying to get a model about you and your person. And I mean, like they read your emails, like anytime you allow it to like schedule your calendar from your email, it's read your email and it's had to compute and understand what your email is about in order to do that simple act of just putting an event in your calendar. And at the other end, I was interested in like again, coming from my background as a photographer, like independent zine making, where people are doing really, really personal, intimate activities, often for like no personal, there's no monetary gain to it. Like nobody makes a zine in order to get rich. Like they're doing it for love, and they're doing it because they want to express something. And like what would happen if you were to use all of that same kind of infrastructure to try and make something that is not for ad revenue, but is actually just an attempt at like something personal, an attempt at connection. And it's really interesting because I'd get two reactions largely from people. It would either be, oh, this is so cool, like, ah, this is great, I love this little weird little zine, or they'd be like, this is incredibly creepy and I can't believe you've built this. But I would be there in front of them saying, I can tell you every line of code in the application and what it does, but you, by having a Gmail account in the first place, have consented to people you don't know reading, you know, your intimate details of what you say in and out, you know. And it basically, like, the like whether or not people felt the piece worked resonated with how much they used their Gmail, because if they used it more, it would get more information about them and produce probably a better zine, whereas if they didn't, and were thereby, like, you know, they weren't giving things to Google, then they would be like, oh, this doesn't work as well, you know, this hasn't found anything interesting.
You did a project on Britain as well. It's called Object Permanence.
Object Permanence. Yeah, it was
in collaboration with V&A.
Yeah, it was part of a residency at the V&A, and it was one of the like curatorial assistants described it as like airing the V&A's dirty laundry in its own living room, because the idea was like to use the V&A has like a public API where you can access their archival documents of like all the pieces they have, and you know, I used that to try and find items that had been taken during acts of colonial atrocity, because the V&A is entirely like its entire history is colonial, based in colonialism. It was originally the East India Museum, and it was the V&A and the Science Museum were just full of everything that had been looted from throughout the colonies of the British Empire. In fact, even the word loot is looted from Hindi, like it's been taken because they needed a word for what they were doing. But when you look at a lot of these archival like artifacts, or you look at like the sort of descriptions that go with them, they're very innocuous. They're just like, oh, this just happened into the into the collection from a kind benefactor. But actually, a lot of these items were taken from what was called the Loot Fund, which was if there was a put down, or if there was a rebellion, if there was some sort of a attack, things would just be taken, and then they would be sort of used to pay soldiers' pensions and to pay bonuses and that kind of thing, and then they would then end up being donated to the museum by those soldiers. So it's kind of this like roundabout thing. There's a very interesting researcher called Alice Proctor who runs these uncomfortable art tours. And I went to the one at the V&A, and she sort of goes around and says, this was taken from here and this was taken from here. And like, this isn't the history, like the plaque says something else, but you know, that's, and like by piecing those things together and by doing this kind of research and by trying to look at how the person that donated it related to some British general or whatever, you can try to trace these items and try to see how they how they ended up in the collection and where they actually came from. And it's that kind of like very material items, but like then accessing them like through an API that is just basically allows you to see, to cross-check different like keywords against like against the item. And a lot of these items aren't on display, they're in sort of also in just in a warehouse, because there's not enough space in the V&A to show them all like all the time. So yeah,
so it seems to me that a lot of your artwork essentially the thematically circulates about around this invisible axis of or a question of power.
Mm-hmm.
And power in technology, power in capitalism, power mm-hmm. in colonial history, and ways to resist that. So my question would be, you know, how do you see the role of an artist, and perhaps of your own art,
mm-hmm.
In relation to these topics?
I mean, I'm interested in the idea of like technology and power, because often technology is just a way of like, you have like abstract power, or like coercive power or like societal power, and technology is often a way of trying to turn that into a solid form. The sort of surveillance ideas of like Google and that kind of thing, and as soon as it becomes the tool, as soon as the technology exists, it's then harder to fight against it, because it's just the way it is then, you know, it kind of begins to decide the power relations. But like, how does the artist fit into this? I mean, like, again, going back to that idea that like all of these things are so complex. If as a single artist stood up and just tried to like take down the entire of capitalism, it's not going to happen. But I mean, if you can try to have new ways of critiquing or new ways of thinking about these issues, you know, like if there's a way that you can fight against the like the canon, as it were, of like what has been decided by these technologies. Like, is there a way of that this technology could be used, if it's here now and it exists, like, is there a way of using it in our own way that doesn't, isn't necessarily what was originally intended for it? Like, can we do our own kind of Move 17, and sort of be, if there's all this sort of like power that's telling us how to do something, is there a way that we can do it differently? And like, how do we then, like, how does the power and the technology make us decide to act in different ways? Like, do we then need to do acts where we are, covering our face from security cameras? Are we doing things where we should be using encryption online and this kind of stuff? Like, what does it tell us and where to go? And is, as an artist, can perhaps think through things differently? Like, can you maybe begin to like not just see it as presented and begin to critique it in a way that might be productive towards ways of countering it? Most of the time I've been here, I've been like just researching this and trying to like think through these things. And I've got a I'm showing a few works next week. That the one is like a film that explores sort of structures of power, and the one is a like an AI system that watches the clouds and tries to give future predictions from the clouds. And one is like a sort of meditative VR experience where, using live streams from around the world, it tries to sort of put you in a state where you are both here and there, and you're kind of like a sort of slow, different experience with technology.
Heading towards the end, I would like to ask you about your author's mark.
So I have a sound piece. It's taken from one of the videos that I found that I was when I was researching this film. And it's somebody describing how to use a bee smoker. A bee smoker is this contraption that you put sort of burning items inside it, and then you pump out through like a cone at the end, you pump out smoke. And the person, I mean, maybe we'll play it, but like the idea is it's used as like a way of controlling bees and also subduing bees, and it interrupts technology, not technology, sorry, interrupts their communications, and allows the person to then go in and take honey out. So like it's a way of like taking this mass, controlling it, subduing it, and taking it out. And so in the film, it's kind of drawing parallels between that and between the like aggressive uses of tear gas that have been in recent years in many protests, which is again used in a very similar way to like try to coerce crowds or get them to go away or disperse or subdue in that kind of way.
We puff the smoke at the entrance to the colony. So we'll just puff smoke at the entrance there. And that gets the guard bees to go in and they eat honey. So while they're eating honey, they're not defending the hive. The smoke works in three different ways. That's one. It's also a bit of a repellent, so the bees move away from the smoke, which makes it easier to put your hands where you want within the hive. The other thing that the smoke does is it interrupts their communication, their scent communication. If one bee becomes agitated, it produces alarm pheromone, and that basically tells all the other bees to respond aggressively. When we puff smoke inside the hive, we can short-circuit that communication. All they smell is smoke, and they can't communicate in that manner. But the bees that go in and eat honey, they're busy gorging and filling up on honey, and so that gives them something else to do, so they're not defending the hive.